hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3108, Representative Winkler. I know he's here. I just talked to him. He's somewhere. There he is.
You're up.
Representative Winkler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the House File 3108 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. And, Mr. Chair, I do have a DE amendment that I'd also like to offer.
All right. To the delete everything amendment?
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one modification in the DE amendment to put it in the shape I think we should discuss it. And the one change is on line 3.5. And the DE amendment strikes the word may and inserts the word shall, and I would like to remove that one change.
Representative Winkler, what did you say you're going to do?
On line 3.5, I would like to reinsert the word may and strike the word shall, so
right.
Essentially undo that change.
All right, we'll incorporate that into the amendment, and then, all right. And Representative Winkler, we have a quorum, so we could act on this amendment and move the amendment into the bill, and then the bill would be in the shape you want it. So all those, any more discussion to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, to your bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, this is part three of the work that was done in the interim and in the first few weeks of session here to try to find items in the bills, the election bills that were vetoed last session that are not controversial, supported by local elected officials, and are found to be valuable, in fact, to members of both parties. And it's a long bill. There are lots of provisions in here, most of which are, I would say, technical. Some of the highlights, I think, are sections 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and well, 12. And those provisions were in a bill that Representative Simon carried last year. That would allow the statewide voter registration system to be automatically updated with data provided by the Department of Health, the Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, essentially making sure that we do not have people who are registered who are not eligible to vote, and that would be done on a more automatic basis. The Section 32, I think, is of interest. There is a current court case pending which would strike down Minnesota's law limiting access to polling places on Election Day. And Section 32 creates an exemption for media organizations who are doing exit polling, which we think would make this provision constitutional under the First Amendment. Section 29 deals with identical names on the ballot. That's been a bill that this committee has heard. Sections 49 and 50 deal with the special election to Congress. This was these were sections that were removed from the absent or from the early primary bill that was just signed into law yesterday, and there was a promise to put those into this bill. And I think actually Section 52 fits into that category as well. Section 63 and other related sections deal with postponement of elections due to inclement weather, and I think Representative Paul Anderson is going to present his bill. But given the limited number of election bills likely to be passed this year, we thought it would be most helpful to include it here as well. So those are some of the highlights from my point of view, and I'm happy to take questions from anyone.
All right, discussion to the bill. Representative Simon? All right, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There should be an amendment in members' packets when the time is right, when you think it's
well,
right.
Well, I think the time is right.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair and members, there's an amendment in there. It's marked A10-2185. And I would defer to Mr. Gehring as how it should be labeled. There are blanks there. I guess it's my name. And moving to amend 3108, I'm not sure what page in line it would go on, so I'd look to Mr. Gehring for advice on that.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I can pull up the page line references if you just give me...
All right, why don't you explain what you're going to do, and then we'll go back to Mr. Gehring.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This language was brought to me by the Association of Minnesota Counties, and in particular, in conjunction with the Secretary of State's office. It has to do with special elections for county commissioner, and there's an urgency in one particular county where, unfortunately, there is a member of the county commissioner who's been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and... the succession plan is sort of in doubt, and in order to comply with the Federal MOVE Act, this language probably needs to be there. I've already discussed it with Representative Kiffmeyer, Secretary of State's office, and everyone's okay with this, with one exception, Mr. Chair. I'd like to orally amend, if I could, something on the second page of this amendment, incorporate it, if that's okay. It's on line 2.6. And I just got this language this morning. Apparently, this is the way it's supposed to be phrased, and Representative Kiffmeyer has signed off on this. The Secretary of State's office has as well. That is, on line 2.6, strike from the word special to the period and insert the words successor is elected and qualified. I'll repeat it. On line 2.6, strike from the word special to the end of the period and in its place, insert the words successor is elected and qualified. That would be my proposed modification to the amendment.
Does everyone have that addition to the amendment? Mr. Gehring, to the first part of the amendment, are we do we have the page in line yet where this would go?
Mr. Chair, yes, I think we do.
Where would it?
Okay, so on line 1.1, the committee would be moving to amend House File 3108, the delete everything amendment as follows. The first reference on 1.2 would be page 36 after line 5. We'd be inserting a new section number 69. On line 1.20, this would be a new section number 70. On line 2.10, this would be page 36 after line 21. It would be a new section 71. And then Representative Simon already mentioned the change in the language.
All right, we'll incorporate Representative Simon's change on line 2.6 as part of the amendment. Does everyone have the amendment? Representative Winkler, you want to comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, this is in the spirit of making a bill that works for everyone involved, so I do support it.
Okay. Any further discussion to the amendment? Representative Simon renews his motion on the A10-2185 amendment as he's incorporated a change. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, to your bill as amended. All right. Representative Anderson, we do have listed House File 2156. You want to explain why that's listed and where it is now? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, House File 2156 arose out of a situation we had a year ago to fill my seat on the county commissioners, and a blizzard came up that Tuesday in March, and not only was the turnout very low, but we had a situation where some of our election judges could have been killed. They had to sit in their precinct until 8 o'clock that evening. The blizzard really got bad. They tried to leave and get home, went in the ditch. They somehow made their way back to the churches where they had been polling and spent the night huddled up in mission blankets, and it was very nearly a disaster out in my county of Pope County. Our county auditors checked during the day as the storm got worse, and there is no provision in state statute to postpone a local election other than townships can postpone elections. So we drew this bill up, had great cooperation with the Secretary of State's office, with the townships and counties, and we're going to include it in the omnibus bill. My thanks to Representative Winkler. And this is how the system should work, a great bipartisan support, working together to get a job done. And I thank all those involved, and I would move to include that in the bill.
Representative Winkler, I believe this is in the bill. Representative Kiffmeyer brought this to us Friday when we were working on the draft of the Delete Everything Amendment. So we incorporated it then with the understanding that we'd give you the opportunity to explain. And so once again, we want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for bringing that to us on Friday.
Thank you very much.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I have nothing further. I ask your support.
All right. We have two people, I believe, who wish to testify. If they want to come down at this time, or maybe we don't have anyone who wishes to testify. All right, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Good morning. I'm Dan McGrath with Minnesota Majority. Jeff Davis wanted to be here to testify on this, but he was unable, so I will deliver his testimony in his stead. I have here prepared copies of his testimony as well as exhibits. If I could get a page to...
We can have a page pass this out.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and other distinguished guests. I'm pleased to have been given the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3108. My testimony represents my professional knowledge and opinion as president of a nonprofit public policy group that has been investigating irregularities in Minnesota elections since October of 2008. Our investigation has revealed a number of concerns, including more ballots than persons that have been accounted for as voting in the election, felon voters, non-citizen voters, underage registrants, non-existent and vacant voter registration addresses, deceased voters on the voter registration rolls, thousands of returned postal verification cards, deficient voter registration records. Please see Exhibit 1 in the package provided for a complete list of our findings. As a result of these findings, we have recommended a number of reforms to Minnesota's electoral process, which can be found in Exhibit 2. Today I'm here to share with you our findings related to discrepancies between certified ballot counts and other election records. The Minnesota statewide voter registration system, it's the official record of registered voters and their vote histories of who has voted in each election. State and federal law requires Minnesota election officials to maintain an accurate system of registered voters and to update voter history records within 6 weeks after an election. In late December 2008, we contacted the Minnesota Secretary of State requesting a public version of the SVRS file which contained the results of the 2008 general election. We were told that SVRS updates were not yet complete. We continued to make regular inquiries with the Secretary of State as to when the updated file would be available for our review. On April 28th of 2009, we contacted Mr. Burt Black, legal counsel for the Secretary of State's office, who informed us that all county election updates had been completed. We could pick up a copy of the SVRS file. It's worthwhile noting that this was nearly 6 months after the election and 4 months after the completion of the Coleman-Franken recount. Upon receipt of the SVRS file, we conducted a number of analyses on the records, including a comparison of the number of individuals who were recorded as having voted in the 2008 general election to the general election results certified by the State Canvassing Board. This comparison revealed that there were over 40,000 more ballots certified by the Canvassing Board than there were voters accounted for as having voted according to the SVRS history file. On May 14, 2009, we sent an email to Mr. Black informing him of our findings and requesting an explanation for the discrepancy. On May 21st, we contacted Mr. Black by telephone, at which time he acknowledged that it appeared counties had not yet completed their SVRS updates and that there appeared to be a widespread problem. And those were Mr. Black's words. On May 29th, Mark Ritchie publicly acknowledged that Minnesota's election records were out of balance. Several weeks later, Secretary Ritchie stated that the election officials had narrowed the discrepancy to approximately 17,000 votes. After this, there were no further updates from the Secretary of State's office as to the status of the balancing effort. Our organization obtained an updated version of the SVRS file on September 25, 2009 to determine what progress had been made in narrowing the difference. To our surprise, the discrepancy appeared, at first, to have actually increased by over 2,000 votes. However, after accounting for records that had been added or removed from the April version of the file, we were able to narrow the difference to approximately 25,000. A worksheet summarizing the differences between the two versions of SVRS and the official canvassing board results can be found in Exhibit 3. Over the past several weeks, we have conducted additional research into the balancing problem by collecting copies of official election records from a number of precincts, original precinct polling place rosters, absentee ballot envelopes, etc. We focused in on a number of precincts that appeared to have large discrepancies between SVRS counts and the official election results. We obtained copies of polling place rosters, election day registration, signature pages, and absentee ballot listings from three precincts in Ramsey County. We counted the total number of persons recorded as having voted from these source documents and compared these counts to SVRS and the certified canvassing board results. The results of this exercise are presented in Exhibit 4. In all three precincts, none of the election records appeared to be in balance. In each precinct, there appear to be more ballots than accounted for voters. The results of our investigation have led us to conclude that Minnesota election officials appear to have failed to comply with a number of existing state and federal election statutes. Please see Exhibit 5 for that. In addition, we believe that Minnesota's election system would benefit from a number of specific reform measures, which are listed on Exhibit 2. In closing, let me say I cannot overemphasize the importance of ensuring the integrity of our electoral process. Fair, honest, accurate, and timely elections are a cornerstone of our constitutional republic. Voters must have confidence in our elections, for failure to ensure public confidence undermines the legitimacy of our entire government. The findings of our research suggest there is reason for voters to question the integrity of Minnesota's elections. An election in which we have just had a major U.S. Senate race decided by fewer than 400 votes demonstrates the importance of election integrity issues we have discovered, including a discrepancy of thousands of votes between the official system of record for who voted in the election with the official certified ballot counts for the same election. Without an accurate record of who voted in an election, it is impossible to conduct high-order integrity verifications, such as confirming that everyone who voted in an election was actually eligible to do so. Our finding that original precinct-level voter records tell a different story than the canvassing board report shows that reconciling ballots at the precinct level is critical. Using an old banking analogy, if you don't know how much money is in the vault, how do you know if there is any money missing? I urge this committee to support the reforms being put forward in House File 3108. The bill is a positive step in the right direction, but additional reforms are still required. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me the time to appear before the committee and extend my remarks in the form of this written testimony.
Representative Gutwell, is it your question to the testifier or to the bill?
Mr. Chair, mine is to the bill, specifically the 2185 amendment that we passed.
All right,
I'll wait on that.
All right. Then thank you very much. And then, Representative Gutwell, why don't you, before we have the next person, why don't you come up, but we'll handle your question now.
Mr. Chair, I realize this apparently came up on fairly short notice. I'm back on the A10-2185 amendment that we passed. I'm noticing that there's no time on it, and not that I'm wanting to be obstructionist at all, but we have times on almost every other amendment in this committee, and I'm not sure when this one came forward. I'm also wondering what it's trying to accomplish. I'm wondering why we're making this change.
Representative Simon, you want to go ahead?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, this was submitted yesterday. But the language that I got, the oral amendment, is one that I got today that I was told that I needed to make to kind of be in harmony with the way these things are usually done. The reason for this, Representative Gottwald, the immediate reason is that, I mean, candidly, I think AMC would tell you this should have been in the early primary bill. I think that's why they came to me. It's not my county that's affected. I think this was an oversight on someone's part, and it should have been in that bill. But basically, in order to comply with the Federal MOVE Act and have a 45-day absentee ballot period before both the general and the primary, current law would be out of balance. Current law would be in conflict with the federal law. And so to be consistent with what we're doing at all other levels, we have to lengthen the period for primary and general elections for a special. And the reason this is urgent to do now and that we don't want to just wait till next year is that there's one particular county where there's a county commissioner who's been diagnosed with a terminal illness and is literally, as I understand it, as it's been explained to me, waiting until this issue is resolved in order to resign, to know that the transition will be in an orderly way. So that's why.
Representative Gobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I had heard about that. I believe it's involving Commissioner Ledoux. My concern is, I noticed that there's a may and not a shall in the first section of that, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, Mr. Chair, but just trying to understand what this is actually doing. And a question about why we wouldn't just go ahead with the current law that says you have to have a special election.
Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwalt, my understanding is, and what AMC is saying, is that under current law, we would be not in compliance with the MOVE Act. That if you had the special election, that it would trigger a period that doesn't meet the standards set forth in the MOVE Act. In other words, it wouldn't allow for a 45-day absentee period both before the general election and the primary election. I guess that's the underlying problem.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Pulaski and Vice Chair Poppe. And members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me the honor of submitting testimony for this important hearing. My association is endorsing House File 3108 because of important protections it would spell out in support of exit pollsters' access to voting places. My name is Gail Belkengren. I'm the president of the Minnesota Upper Midwest chapter of the Market Research Association. It's the leading and largest association of the survey and opinion research profession. MRA promotes, advocates, and protects the integrity of the research profession and the research process. I'm a lifelong Minnesota resident with more than 35 years of experience in the marketing research field, and I actually did some exit polling for ABC in my early on in my career. MRA appreciates the efforts in House File 3108 to promote genuine research by ensuring that exit pollsters can legally do their research near voting places in Minnesota. Current Minnesota statute doesn't allow anyone except an elected or election official or an individual who is waiting to register or to vote to stand within 100 feet of the polling place building. This bill would add to that exception, or an individual who is conducting exit polling, and defined exit polling as approaching voters in a predetermined pattern as they leave the polling place after they have voted and asking voters to fill out an anonymous written questionnaire. Exit pollsters' access to voting places and voters is essential to this kind of research. The greater the distance between a researcher and the voting place, the more likely voters are going to leave without ever having an opportunity to share their opinions. The typical exit poll questionnaire gathers three types of data. First, who the research participant voted for in the day's key elections in a particular jurisdiction. Second, a variety of attitudes held by the voter. And third, the demographic characteristics of the voter. Now, the latter two sets of information can be used to explain why they voted as they did and what kinds of people voted for each candidate. These exit poll questionnaires are relatively short, typically less than 25 questions, and take less than 5 minutes to complete. Most people think of election night projections on TV when they think of exit polling. However, this research is just as important for the information gathered about the voters' demographics and attitudinal predispositions towards the candidates and the campaign issues as it is for making the projections reported by news organizations on election night. It is this data that provides powerful explanations to be examined in election postmortems and by academics and researchers forever after for why people voted the way they did, telling us which key demographic groups voted for which candidates or which propositions and why. An exit poll is the only kind of poll that can affirmatively assume that its participants actually voted. Finally, exit polls do something pre-election polls cannot do. It captures the voting intent of last-minute deciders. In 2004, 5% of voters made up their minds on who to vote for on election day. 11% decided whom to vote for in the last week before the election. This data was gathered according to exit polls. It is also important to note that a majority of such research is actually conducted by survey and opinion research organizations and companies, not just the TV organizations. MRA appreciates you have included all bona fide exit polling in your legislation. On behalf of MRA and the entire survey and opinion research profession, thank you again for holding this hearing and your efforts on House File 3108, and thank you for letting me submit testimony. I and the entire national organization look forward to assisting to in whatever capacity you might require.
Representative Kiffmeyer, is this to the testifier? All right, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Ms. Belkengren. I think the question that I would have and a concern I had about this legislation was for the voters, that this legislation, this particular piece here, seems to give unlimited access to the polling place. And, again, my concern is for the voters. Would it be your intention that in doing these surveys, how close would you be or how would you handle, because we have protections for the voters, too, in their privacy, their rights to privacy in the voting process, and also to their being able to go and vote without being hindered or feeling like this is an uncomfortable situation for them. How would you handle those kinds of, you know, respectfulness for our voters?
Ms. Belkren.
Certainly. Thank you for your question. I would. This is Minnesota, and it's November for Election Day, so there's obviously inclement weather to deal with. There are sections of this bill that deal specifically with that. So I would expect that our interviewers would be inside the building. They don't necessarily have to be inside the room. They could be in front of the front door or inside the front door of the building as people are leaving. They don't necessarily have to be in the room of the building.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I had this concern about it, but there's a court case, so just so you understand, the real situation here is that the courts have dictated this circumstance, and so this legislation is complying with that court situation. And so for us, I had my concerns about it, but because of the already decided court case, it seems as though this is necessary to be in compliance, even though we have our concerns, and I would hopefully ask that the media and others would be very respectful of the voters.
They always are.
Ms. Belkren, let's go through the chair, please.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Belkengren, and I do that, but I think we just want to be sure that we just emphasize that and would be expecting that would be the case. Thank you.
Representative Lanning, is this to the testifier?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. To the testifier, do you have any data at all as to how many people refuse to respond to an exit poller?
I don't have that data.
Ms. Belkren.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Practice for when you're out doing your polling at the polling place. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little surprised to hear that you don't have any data as to how many people refuse. I suspect that there's a fairly significant percentage of the population that regards this as an intrusion and would refuse to participate or have refused to participate. And I'm uncomfortable with that myself.
All right. Further discussion, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, to Representative Lanning, I just want to be very clear. Right now, the court will, we have a rule against having people within 100 feet of the building. The court will strike that down if it doesn't allow media organizations to do exit polling specifically. And so the reason for this provision is to make sure that we do have a 100-foot rule for most people, but to the extent the courts require us to allow the press under the First Amendment to be closer, we're just trying to craft that as narrowly as we possibly can, and that's why this provision is drafted the way it is.
All right. Thank you. Members, we have one more addition. Mr. Gehring has discovered that we need one more addition to clarify something. So, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, this is a conforming change related to the postponement of election for inclement weather. Page 34, line 33, the amendment would be to delete the term local law enforcement agencies and insert a law enforcement agency singular, so that this is a section that has to do with postponing a town election or town meeting, and the language here is to conform with the new provisions related to school board and county and city postponements. So you'd be changing the language to from plural law enforcement agency to singular. And then also on page 35, line 1, we'd delete have.
All right. Representative Winkler, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, I do, and I would move the amendment.
All right. Representative Winkler moves the amendment. Any further discussion to the Representative Gutwald? Representative Gutwald? All right. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the bill, we have worked very hard together with Representative Winkler, myself, Secretary of State's office, the local election officials, and others as well, to address multitudes of concerns. But I think the most important thing is about the voters, and I think that they deserve an election that gives them confidence. I think these are the kind of measures that will increase that. And the other thing is that our election judges in the polling place work very, very hard. But they do have a long day in front of them. The more specific we can be about some of the requirements, it's actually easier for them because they just have one day to get it right. And as we've seen from recounts, the goal is that if there is a recount, that the voter confidence would be increased because we can tie back and have accuracy in the polling place on election day. And that whole process, so that a recount would actually affirm and strengthen the confidence, not weaken that. I think these measures have included both integrity and preserved the access and accomplished a lot of things here for the voters. And I think there are other things that we can do, but I think this year it was the art of the possible, that which we could agree to, that was really a defining factor here. And certainly there are always measures we can work to improve. I'm looking forward to seeing these implemented. And want to thank everybody for their involvement and participation and getting this to the table today. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I would echo Representative Kiffmeyer's comments and be ready to renew my motion.
All right. So why don't you do that?
Mr. Chair, then I would renew my motion that House File 3108, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Simon, House File 224. Representative Simon, I'm going to move that House File 224 be recommended to pass and be referred to civil justice. Members, so we're clear on what's going to happen here today. We are going to take testimony after the bill is put into the shape that the author wishes to have it. And when we are out of time, we are going to go to a vote. So just so it's clear, the vote will be to send the bill to civil justice as amended, and we will go as long as we can today, but that vote will be the last thing we'll do on the bill. So all the testifiers fully understand that, too. We'll get as far as we can through the testimony, and it's going to be balanced. So Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, I'd like to put on the DE amendment to get it in the shape that I'd like.
All right. Why don't you explain the amendment?
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, just put it on first and then explain.
All right, go ahead.
If that's okay.
Move it.
I'll move it. Thanks.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Members, we're here on an issue.
Representative Simon, yep. we have one technical amendment, so I'm going to go to Mr. Gehring on a technical amendment that we need to incorporate here. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, on page 10, line 11, the reference to Subdivision 8 should read Subdivision 9.
All right. Representative Simon, we're going to incorporate that into your amendment.
Great.
So just so you know it's there. All right. Representative Simon.
Thanks, members. We're here on an issue that is important to all of us. It's not a lawyer issue. It's not a court issue. It's not a judge issue. It's an everybody issue because in every courthouse in every county in the state, there are judges making life and death decisions for people. It affects their livelihoods. It affects their liberty. It affects who gets custody of children. It's serious business. And all of us want to make sure that the people who occupy those positions are people who are ethical, who are honest, but most important, are impartial. And I think there's a threat right now that that may no longer be the case in future years. We're really here more directly because of a decision called the White decision, which the second iteration of it came down in 2005, and I and some members in this room have been working on this issue since the latter part of 2005. And basically, members, here's what the White decision essentially said. There were three things that judges couldn't do before the White decision, or certainly couldn't do easily, that they can now do. They can raise money directly from individuals. They couldn't do that before. They can solicit and accept all sorts of partisan political endorsements. They couldn't do that, and now they can. And most important and most damaging, and this is the number one issue why this is important, judges and judicial candidates can now announce their positions on disputed legal issues likely to come before the court. Now think about that for a minute. A judge can go out and campaign on outcomes, promised outcomes. Now, when you and I, members, campaign, we gladly and freely talk about outcomes. That's what we do, and that's natural and normal and healthy. You might say, vote for Representative Gottwalt, you're going to get more of this, less of that. Vote for Representative Winkler, you're going to get more of this, less of that. And we announce our positions. It's not a secret. We don't pretend to be neutral on most of them. But that kind of dynamic has no place in a judicial election. To have judges announcing beforehand how they're going to rule on a particular case or issue or on a category of issues, to say, I'm the pro-choice judge, I'm the pro-life judge, I'm the pro-business judge, I'm the pro-labor judge, vote for me. And they can now do that. Now, the White case was very arguably, I believe, probably rightly decided. The Supreme Court said, look, if you're going to have a candidate versus candidate election, you can't muzzle their speech and tell them they can't talk about certain things. So this is a way around that to make sure that we change the way that we select and retain judges in the state. And if we do nothing, then, and if we're sure that the system that's worked for the past several decades will always work, if we just wait for the storm to come, then I think we're really in trouble. And I think that storm is coming. And you look to other states, members, neighboring Wisconsin has faced this twice in the last 5 years, states like Tennessee, Ohio, Alabama, Texas, and others, where what happens in this new environment is you have very high-dollar, ideologically driven, and most importantly, outcome-based campaigns for judge. And I don't think we can have that in a democracy. I don't think that's healthy, and I don't think it's right. So this is one way to solve that problem. To the bill does primarily two things. Article 1 of the bill, and I'm speaking to the DE amendment, Article 1 of the bill is the constitutional amendment language that would switch us to a retention election system. It would be a simple up or down vote on a judge, yes or no on Judge Gottwalt, for example, not Judge Gottwalt versus challenger Jane Doe. That allows for maximum competition, and I think it gets around a current system that is frankly elitist. Under the current system, all of us know as voters that when you turn over that backside of the ballot, almost none of the judges running for re-election have any competition. Almost none. About 95% do not. With a retention election system, every judge, every time, could conceivably lose his or her job if a majority voted no. That's not the situation right now, where almost all judges skate through without any opposition. The second thing in Article 2 that this bill focuses on is creating a performance evaluation commission to independently evaluate a judge's performance twice during the judge's terms. I think we all believe that judges need accountability, just like we have accountability. Citizens need information. They don't really have it now. The results would be released, and there would be no mention of the findings on the ballot. The judge would simply stand for retention, up or down. In other states, Missouri, Arizona, Colorado, this has worked very well. And one-time opponents, people who had fought it when it was passed, now are clamoring to be part of it, such as in Arizona, where it started out originally in Maricopa County in Phoenix, and now the rest of the state's district court and other judges are all for it and clamoring to be a part of it. So we have to ask ourselves, who really stands to benefit if we do nothing? If we let the white regime persist, and if, as I believe is inevitable in Minnesota, we're fortunate it hasn't happened yet, but if we get these high-dollar, big-buck, ideologically-driven, and outcome-based judicial elections saying, vote for me, I'll obtain this result. Vote for me, I'll stop this. Vote for me, here's my philosophical inclination on this manner of cases. If we get that, who stands to benefit? And it is the people on the fringes who want to make more ideological judicial elections and contests, and I don't think that's a good thing. The support for this bill is broad. You should have in your handouts, and you should have received a list of coalition members. I can think of only one time in my 6 years here where I've seen a letter signed by both the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, by both the Center of the American Experiment on the right and Growth and Justice on the left. And this is an extraordinary coalition that's been many, many years in the making. My only regret today is that we don't quite have the District Court Judges Association on board. We've been in intense negotiations with them for months. They said they would support the bill. The first time they've ever come out in favor of retention elections, which 2 years ago, for members who remember, they weren't. Now they are. But they said they had four conditions. They were quite steep hills to climb, and we had to gulp hard to accommodate them, and this bill is full of accommodations to them. One was they wanted a steady stream of funding. We found that, though this isn't a finance committee, I can talk about it, but it doesn't hit the general public at all. It's an increased filing fee on judges and an increased registration fee for lawyers, so the general public will not be hit by this. They also wanted to make sure that this entity doing the evaluating was independent outside of the judicial branch. We did that for them. The third thing they wanted is some sort of trigger language or some electoral election law language that would comfort them so that they'd know a challenge was coming in advance, and that there wouldn't be the sneak attack in October, and that committees would have to register, and that those doing independent expenditures would have to give them advance warning. We put that in the bill, and it is in the bill at their behest. The only thing that isn't in the bill that the District Court Judges Association wanted was they wanted system-wide merit selection. Currently, we have merit selection system for district court judges, and it is optional, not mandatory, although the last several governors have followed it anyway, even though it's optional. They wanted it both mandatory and system-wide. Although I support that and would carry a separate bill for that, I do worry that that would draw a gubernatorial veto, as it is cutting significantly into any governor's power, and I wasn't willing to doom the bill in order to accommodate that concern. But three out of four ain't bad, members, and I think you'll hear from the district court judges that we're quite close and we're continuing to talk. So, members, I'll turn it over to other testifiers.
Representative Simon, before you leave, a couple of questions. Article 1 is constitutional amendment. That does not have to be signed by the governor, but Article 2 would be. Can you tell me the position of the governor on Article 2?
No, I can't, Mr. Chair. And the reason I can't is, as you know, with this governor, and it's rational behavior, and it's good negotiation. I'd advise him the same way. As with many bills around here, the governor likes to hold things close to his chest.
Representative Simon, this bill has been around for a long time.
I agree.
What happens if the governor vetoes Article 2?
If the governor vetoes Article 2, the language in Article 1 goes straight to the ballot.
I understand that. What happens to the implementation of Article 1?
What would happen is we would come back next year, if this made it onto the ballot, and assuming it passed the ballot, we would come back next year and we would have to basically do this over again.
And Representative Simon, is there a fiscal note to this bill?
There will be. There isn't yet.
There have been some numbers.
Correct.
Presented to my office over the last year.
Yep.
So, and these were firm numbers. So can you tell the committee what those numbers are?
I can. Based on 2 years ago, the number was roughly $600,000 or $700,000 per year.
And Representative Simon, how much money is generated by the fees in Article 2?
Well, Mr. Chair, we left a blank for that number, and we're happy in discussing it with the Bar Association and the District Court judges. There's more than enough money to cover this, we believe.
You believe. This isn't a fiscal committee, but this is a huge fiscal issue, and there are related fiscal issues in this bill. I'm not going to go any further with you on that issue, but with the testifiers, certainly that's going to be a discussion, and a relevant discussion to the implementation of this bill. So at this point, do you want testifiers brought up?
Yes.
Or are there questions of Representative Simon at this point?
If I might just add one more thing.
Representative Simon.
As to the other language, you know, as you know, members, any of you, and most of you have, carried a bill that has a lot of moving parts, that goes through a lot of committees, that has a lot of stakeholders. It's tough to strike that right balance. One approach would have been to do what the proponents of the last constitutional amendment, the so-called legacy amendment, did, which they were very sparing on the front end. And according to staff and others I've talked to, I'm not on the environmental committee, so forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but they tell me that only about one-third of the necessary enabling language was put onto the bill that carried through the constitutional amendment, the thought being, look, we don't have to reach these issues yet. We can wait until after it's passed and then do it, which is what we did when we came back in 2009. That was one approach, but a lot of the stakeholders, including the district court judges, didn't want that. They wanted to spell everything out in advance.
Well, Representative Simon, I might argue that the cuts that have been implemented on the court system over the last few years would beg that this bill be as tight as possible and be resolved. For those of us who have heard from our courts the impact of these cuts, I would say passing a bill that has blank appropriation and blank impact, I really don't want to go back and face Judge Jeff Thompson, who isn't here today, but who I'll see probably tomorrow, and have a discussion about what's happening in the courts in Winona.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. I'm just explaining to the committee and to members and to the public why there's all this language in here. One other approach would have been to be very sparing and just say, as we did with the last amendment, we didn't put it as an accommodation to many of the stakeholders, and there are many, and it's a balancing act, and I'm trying and have for the last 4.5 years done my very best to accommodate all the interests.
I understand that, Representative Simon, but there are other concerns here, too.
I understand.
Major concerns with this budget. All right, do you wish to have testifiers come forward?
Yes.
Or do members want questions of Representative Simon at this point? All right, let's have the testifiers. First on my list, the Chief Justice. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Eric Magnuson, the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. You have a lot of people who want to get your ear on this, so I will try to be very brief. Every year, 2 million cases go through the Minnesota courts. We have a hardworking and efficient judicial system. We also have a justice system that is well respected by the citizens of this state. Recent surveys have shown a high degree of public trust and confidence in the work that the judges do. You know, in Minnesota, in any other state, about half of the people lose their cases when they go to court. You have to have winners and you have to have losers. But what our surveys show is that people feel they've been treated fairly. They've been listened to. They've been given a chance to make their case. That's what makes the justice system work. Now, I say that we have that confidence right now, but it is threatened. There are some who believe that the situation will continue the way it is, that we're not going to have the kind of divisive, contentious elections that you see in other states. You will hear from other speakers. All you have to do is look at Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, millions and millions of dollars were spent in hotly contested Supreme Court races, resulting in the defeat of an incumbent justice based on campaign contributions from a wide variety of sources and ads that anyone would say were damaging to the justice system. I'm not talking about candidates. I think candidates should stand and fall on their own merits. But when you have a system that leads the public to believe that campaign contributions influence outcomes, you are damaging the justice system immeasurably. It is not just a John Grisham novel. You don't have to look any further than the Caperton decision in West Virginia that went to the United States Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said, as a matter of due process, campaign contributions interfere with the right of a person to get a fair trial. Now, what happens is such a great risk that you have to do something about it. You cannot say that it won't happen here. It happens next door in Wisconsin. It's going to happen here. And you can't say the problem will go away. The Supreme Court in White said there are First Amendment principles that apply when you elect judges in contested elections. And basically, the Supreme Court said, if you don't like the application of those First Amendment principles, then change how you elect judges. The proposal that you have before you does that. It proposes a system that ensures appropriate accountability to the citizens of the state by members of the judiciary. And as Representative Simon said, you know, when you go into the voting booth and you turn over that ballot because for some reason the judges are always on the back page, and you take a look at it, how many of you really know who you're voting for? And how many of you would benefit from having a recommendation from an independent body who has looked at the performance of a judge and who has said this judge is qualified? I'm not here to discuss all the details of the legislation with you. You're going to hear from a number of people. I'm a member of a national committee on state court and federal court jurisdiction. We have chief justices on it from all over the country. We filed a report with the United States Supreme Court that said this: the growing sums of election campaign donations and garish media messages associated with judicial elections are distracting citizens and sometimes candidates from appreciating the need for an unbiased judiciary. As retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor warned, in too many states, judicial elections are becoming political prize fights where partisans and special interests seek to install judges who will answer to them instead of to the law and to the Constitution. I support this legislation for several reasons. First, as I've said, the current system threatens public trust and confidence in Minnesota. It's not a question of whether we're going to have hotly contested partisan elections. It is only a question of when. And the evidence across the country is overwhelming. When you engage in those kinds of contests, the public loses confidence in the judicial system. Point two, under the proposal, partisan and special interest groups really can't buy a seat. The most they can do is convince the electorate to get rid of the incumbent, but they can't put their own person in that spot. You can't have what John Grisham's novel proposed. If a judge is defeated, a merit-based selection system picks the replacement. Point three, a retention public performance system minimizes the amount and the influence of campaign contributions. That has been the experience in retention election jurisdictions across the state. And point four, a judicial retention performance evaluation really provides meaningful accountability. Judges get judged on the merits, and the public gets the information. I am the third Chief Justice to support this proposal. You will hear also from my two immediate predecessors, Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz and Chief Justice Russell Anderson, who believe that this is a change that we have to make in light of the Supreme Court's decisions. Politicized elections are a very real and current threat to our justice system, and we need to act decisively to retain not only the independence of the judiciary, but the accountability. And I want to make one last point. As the chairman pointed out, Minnesota is in the midst of an economic and budgetary crisis. There is a temptation to say, let's put this aside and not deal with it now because we have other things to deal with. I really thought that I'd get a break from talking about the budget because I've been doing that a lot almost everywhere I go. But it's never an issue that's very far away. The cost of this proposal is not insignificant, but it is manageable. And the cost of not doing it is absolutely monumental to the citizens of this state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chief Justice, just a clarification, just so I'm clear. You testified that this problem does not exist in Minnesota, yet we're proposing a constitutional amendment to address a problem that does not exist here. You then stated that there is a problem that exists here, a major problem, with the cuts to the court. Can you tell me what the governor recommended for cuts to the court system?
The governor recommended about $14 million.
And what's in the Senate budget proposal for cuts to the court?
A little bit more than that.
And it's likely that this body may also recommend cuts to the court, after a succession of cuts to the court. So I want to be clear. It's more important that in this bill we create revenue streams to address a problem that does not exist in Minnesota rather than address a problem that has existed and that is persistent in Minnesota, the cuts to the court. Am I clear on that, Chief Justice?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that your premise is faulty.
When
I said we haven't had these kinds of elections yet, I emphasized yet. The problem exists. The problem is the manner in which we elect our judges.
So, Chief Justice, it's more important to create brand new revenue streams to address a problem that doesn't exist in Minnesota rather than to address a persistent and increasing problem in the court system. I'm trying, Chief Justice, to get a handle on what is important to you and the courts.
To me, an adequately funded judiciary and a system that is accountable and not fraught with politics is of paramount importance. If it were up to me, Mr. Chairman, we would not be cutting courts. We would be adding revenue to courts so that they could adequately do their job. The fact that money is tight doesn't mean that you stop addressing issues, and this is an issue that must be addressed. If you don't fix the roof when the sun is shining and you wait until it's raining,
You've really made a big mistake, and I fear that that's what's going to happen.
And, Mr. Chief Justice, it's interesting because language quite similar to that has been told to me by my local judges for the last 5 years, but it hasn't been on this issue. It's been on what's happened to the court systems in this state.
Well, and, you know, I have you have a limited amount of time here today, and I would be happy to engage in a discussion with you on the other compelling needs to fund the justice system.
Chief Justice, you've been in my office, and at least twice a month I have a standing dinner with Judge Thompson, and I think tomorrow night we will have this discussion again, and we'll renew it.
Thank you.
Further questions to the Chief Justice. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, it's I don't think a question to the Chief Justice, but I'd like to weigh in on this discussion. It seems to me that what the Chief talked about when he talked about a lost confidence is something that is very, very hard to regain once lost. And the reason I support this legislation is because I agree that it's going to happen, but reacting to it will mean that we cannot effectively deal with it, because I think once public confidence is disrupted by the kind of elections that we've seen in Wisconsin or in other states, it'll be a long, long time before we can regain that confidence. And to the budget point, I guess I don't think we're in a budget crisis. I think we're in an ongoing budget challenge that will last years. And when the time comes for elections to take this turn, we're likely going to be in the same budget challenge then, and yet we'll have lost the opportunity to prevent the loss of public confidence. So I think it is important to support it, and I think the time is now to do it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chief Justice, you used the analogy that you fix the roof when the sun is shining. I've been reluctant to support this provision because there are, as the chairman stated, there are several problems that need to be addressed while the sun is shining, and sometimes you can only take care of a couple of them. We are on the brink of a tragedy in the court system if the cuts are as deep as some may fear. And we can talk about that. I think we will talk about that more in depth, not in this committee. But my position has changed, and I did not hear either Representative Simon or you, Mr. Chief Justice, address why I believe the sun is no longer shining, but we have to fix the roof because the clouds are dark and they are on the horizon and the winds are blowing quick. And that is the Citizens United case that has opened the floodgates upstream for corporate expenditures independently and may actually open them for corporate direct expenditures. I think that if we do not act, that the same fears, Mr. Chair, that I have, that you've shared, will be so deep and dark, and that we will be in an epic flood of damage to our society across the board, that I think we have to do this. I know that, Mr. Chairman, that your frustration about solving problems with innovative and creative thinking is one that I share. We've seen it on the Viking Stadium. For some reason, we're willing to entertain a lot of ideas on a Viking Stadium, but not on maintaining a civil society. I'm wondering, Mr. Chief, if you could comment briefly on the Citizens United case and the potential impact and why it may increase the urgency to move forward with Representative Simon's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chief Justice.
For those of you who may not have it in mind, Citizens United is the recent United States Supreme Court case that struck down restrictions on campaign expenditures by corporations. It is, again, founded in the Constitution. And whether you agree with that decision or not, it is what the United States Supreme Court has declared the law to be. Just like the White decision, it has eroded the ability of states to control the conduct of elections. It is even more impetus, as you have heard, to act now before we experience the really horrendous result that other states have suffered because they have not had such restrictions on campaign contributions. I think it is just another impetus, as you said, Representative, to fix the roof now that the clouds are gathering and the storm is coming. There is nothing so unique about Minnesota or our citizens or the people who seek office here to believe that we will somehow be immune from the tragedy that really has been experienced in other states.
All right. We've got a long list of testifiers, members. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you very much.
Greg Wersel is next.
Thank you.
Mr. Wersel. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Wersel. I'm an attorney. I've practiced law for 30 years. I was a lead plaintiff in the White case, and I am currently a candidate for the Minnesota Supreme Court. Mr. Chairman, I would first like to address some of the false premises that I think are underlying this bill. It's been brought up, the White decision occurred in 2002, and yet we don't have these elections in Minnesota. We see them in Wisconsin, we see them in Texas, we see them in Pennsylvania. Why not Minnesota? Well, Minnesota is unique. Minnesota is different. And the difference is that we put the word incumbent on the ballot next to the judge's name as a key to all voters who the incumbent is. And that means that when if a voter doesn't have information, they tend to vote for the incumbent, and the incumbent wins. That's not found in any of those other states. It provides a huge protection for the incumbents already in our system. It's been suggested that perhaps money will taint the judicial system, the money in elections. But we have a limit. It was created by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which limits the amount of contribution in judicial campaigns to $2,500. If the legislature believes that's too high, reduce the number. Finally, the Code of Judicial Conduct specifically prohibits judicial candidates from making pledges or promises when they run for office. Now, I'd like to talk about the bill itself, Your Honor. Or excuse me. I've been appearing in court too often. Mr. Chairman, a friend of mine has called the bill constitutional malpractice, and I agree. We live in a representative democracy, and part of that is we have a constitution which creates checks and balances and accountability through elections. The elections provide a forum where a challenger can make known to the public the failings of the incumbent. All of those items are thrown aside by this bill. The amendment does away with the challenger altogether and replaces the challenger with a judicial performance commission. And I want you to focus on what that commission is going to do. The original language in the original bill was found in lines 6.18 through 6.22, and in the amendment is found in lines 9.5 through 9.4 through 9.9. The committee can look at the judge's integrity, his impartiality, his temperament, his punctuality, and then it says the commission may not evaluate judicial performance based on substantive legal issues or opinions subject to appellate processes. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means that the committee can't look at what the judge's decisions are. So if we have a judge, and they are out there, let me tell you, who refuse to give people bail, those people sit in jail over and over and over again. Or worse yet, people, we have judges who give very low bail. And now, an accused child molester is back out on the street. I want you to compare this to if you took your car, if your car wasn't working, wouldn't run, you took it to a shop to get it repaired. You come back 2 days later, you're presented with a bill for $3,000. You go out and try to start the car and it won't run. You go in and talk to the manager and say, hey, my car doesn't run. And he says, well, the employee is a great employee. He's got the temperament of a mechanic and he's always punctual and his job has been reviewed by a commission. And you say, but my car doesn't run. And that's where we're going to be. Because we aren't going to look at what the judge's decisions are. And this is going to create a horrible problem for the public. And then the bill compounds the problem. Because the bill now creates, well, it creates this farce because the public is going to see this little notation on the ballot. So the public is going to see that this judge gets an A-plus from the commission, and the public is going to think, oh, somebody's actually looked at what this judge is doing, whether or not he's actually following the law. And so we're going to have made this problem even worse because we're committing a fraud almost on the public. And then the bill compounds it again because it makes the term of years for once they're elected for 8 years. Now, if you have a group of unaccountable people, and that's what we're going to end up with, a group of unaccountable people, we should be making the term of office shorter and shorter and shorter, not longer and longer. And the final problem with the bill is that there's no check or balance on the appointment power of the governor. Now, I want you to understand that if you look right now, most of our judges are initially appointed to the bench. But under our current system, there is a check on that. The check is that within a short period of time, those people have to come up for election, and the people of Minnesota get to put a check on the power of the governor. That's done away with. We're not going to have any check provided by legislative oversight, no advice or consent from a Senate or the House or any other body. So let's just assume the worst case scenario. Let's assume we have a governor who wants to appoint judges who believe in rather bizarre ideological positions. Well, Minnesota law is soon going to become bizarre. And there's not a check on the system because, again, the commission cannot look at the judge's decisions. They're specifically prohibited from doing that. And so now, compare that. If you took your car in and got it repaired and got it back, and now the mechanics who work on it, they believe that cars should only go in reverse and at 80 miles an hour. And that's what's going to happen to the law of Minnesota. Those are my comments.
Representative Winkler, to the test track.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wurzel, I guess the question I have, and maybe it should be clear to me, is, so is your position that we should not do anything to current Minnesota law?
Mr. Wurzel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, if you do anything, if you want to interject more accountability into the system, you eliminate the word incumbent from the ballot. That would be the primary thing I would say. The second would be you should consider shortening the term of office.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wurzel, you also threw out this phrase, constitutional malpractice, which I think is curious. But, you know, under the federal constitution, we have lifetime appointment. Do you favor also changing the U.S. Constitution to move it to short-term elections?
I think that's beyond the Mr. Chairman, I believe that's beyond the purview of this committee. I would love to address it, but as a practical matter, you also have a check and balance there, which is you have to have advice and consent of the Senate. It doesn't exist in this bill. There is no check.
Mr. Chair, actually, there is a check, and I think your mechanic analogy is weak, frankly, because the very language that you cited says that it's subject to appellate review. That's why we have appellate review, so that if you have a mechanic who thinks that cars should only go in reverse, under the system, you have to go to the mechanic of appeals and then the supreme mechanic to determine whether or not that decision was correct. That is actually what the check in the system is. And I guess I wonder, you also mentioned this issue of limits on judicial contributions. Do you have any concern with unlimited independent expenditures in judicial races?
Mr. Wurzel.
Mr. Chairman, if I could deal with the mechanic analogy.
You may deal with both.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, in the real world, if I didn't like the mechanic, I'd go to a different shop. But I don't have that choice here. I can only go to one set of judiciary. The problem with talking about appeals is it's not a solution. Yes, appeals are very expensive. They cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. So if you're in front of a district court judge and he says the rules XYZ, even though, and I have seen district court judges say, I know there is appellate decisions directly contrary to what I'm ordering, I'm still ordering this. I've seen judges say that. Yes, you can appeal if you can spend another $10,000 to do it. So to talk about an appellate process just isn't a good solution. The better solution is let's get rid of the bad judges. With regard to the money, again, I don't see that there's a problem. I think if we want to, we're going to have outside people spend money in any event. Right now, we haven't had the problem. Like I said, you also have to overcome the word incumbent on the ballot, and I think that's going to prevent the kinds of races we've seen in other states. I would also suggest to you that the problem in Minnesota to date has not been too much money in judicial elections. It's been too little. The most that's ever been spent on a judicial race in Minnesota was several years ago. It was about $380,000, and that was for a Minnesota Supreme Court position, a statewide race, and sometimes, we have legislative races where more money than that is spent. So that hasn't been the problem here.
Mr. Chair, I guess my final comment
would be Winkler, that I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm thinking today, but go ahead. Representative Winkler.
No comment, Mr. Chair, but my final comment would be that if you think that the solution to the problem is that judicial elections should cost more money, then I guess opposition to this bill would make sense.
All right. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chairman, okay. Again, if I can just comment.
Yes,
look,
Mr.
Outside people, Mr. Chairman, can come in and spend money anyway. Here, at least, the incumbent, under the current system, we can have a battle between two challengers. You could have an unfunded group, a corporation, come in and dump $1 million against some incumbent. Is the incumbent going to be able to fight against that? Again, I think if you're going to do this, let's have open and free elections in the state. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Kathleen Blatz. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Kathleen Blatz, and I am here as a private citizen. In my former life, I've had different jobs, including Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I was a trial judge and even a former legislator, but I do not appear in any of those capacities today, but as a private citizen. I would like to comment briefly, though, just to put some context around my remarks. In my 8 years as Chief Justice, I had the opportunity of traveling around this country and becoming somewhat familiar with many different court systems in our states. And while many states are doing impressive things, I can honestly tell you that I always return back to Minnesota, very grateful and very proud of our judiciary here. It is truly outstanding. It is not perfect. No institution made up of human beings is perfect. But we have a court system to be proud of and a court system to protect. So it may seem a little bit contradictory for you to hear my comments today that I am here today in strong support of House File 70, that I want you to change the way judges are elected in Minnesota in order to keep our court system. In other words, to support change to keep the status quo at some level. And I want to tell you also that I've always not been in this position of supporting the concept of retention elections. Having gone through eight legislative races, and I was even here before the chairman was in the legislature, just to put it in kind of old ages, middle ages, or something like that.
Representative Blatz realized that there is a vote on this.
Yes, I know. And Mr. Chairman, I can count votes. Yes, I know. And Mr. Chairman, I can count votes here. At least maybe yours. So,
Representative Blatz, I can too, and you don't have one.
Okay. Thank you. Well, moving on. touche. I did not like the idea of retention elections. And this was, I was a judge at this time, but this was pre-White. And I changed my position pre-White, too. So I was of the mind that if I was going to run for election, having gone through eight legislative ones, that I'm comfortable with campaigns. I always want to know my opponent. If I'm going to lose to somebody, I want to know who I'm going to lose to. Retentions, I thought, then, that I don't want to run against a phantom opponent. because then I would be worried that when people went in to vote, they would say, do I want to retain Judge Blatz? Well, no, and I don't know who they'll replace her with, but anybody will be better than her. And that's tough to run against the phantom perfect replacement. And then one day, I rose above the trees, so to speak, and saw the forest, at least in my view, and realized that what really mattered was not whether Kathleen Blatz, trial judge, Supreme Court, was reelected, but how the person that replaced me got to the bench. And that is what I focused on, and that is really what has led me to support this legislation here today. Because judicial elections, direct elections, have many problems in the judiciary today across this country, even though they have not come to Minnesota. We'll talk about that. I do support the right of the people to vote. Not everybody agrees with this. Some people want appointments. They want all sorts of different things. I am very comfortable with the right of the people to keep and also to remove the judges on the bench. But I'm a realist. I think under the new rules of the game, and we heard those rules spelled out here today, and I think they're still in flux and they'll be changing and not in the direction that I would support. But under the new rules of the game, judicial elections across this country are becoming heavily subsidized by special interests, and this politicization of the judiciary comes with a price, and it's the people of our country and our state that will pay it. Special interests do not support a particular judge because he or she will be fair and impartial. No. They support judges who agree with their particular agenda. They want partial judges, just partial to their agenda. And this, in my view, is the antithesis of what judicial elections should be about. The public has the right to have their cases heard, as we've heard, and you're going to keep hearing, by fair and impartial judges, not judges who have already weighed in on one side. And this weighing in is really what I believe erodes the public's confidence in the judiciary. And polls show that even judges don't believe in judges once they get there, the way that other judges have gotten there in different states, heavily subsidized, very politicized campaigns. And I want to expand, going a little bit off my notes to shorten. The public's confidence, we've heard it, is the lifeblood of the judiciary, and I really want to emphasize that here today. Why? I had 12 years as a judge. Being a judge, you've got tough jobs too. Being a judge is a tough job. There's not very many things that we preside over that are happy times. Adoptions and marriages, when we're asked to perform marriages. Honestly, that sums it up. I'm not saying nothing good happens in court, but people come to court as a last resort. It's expensive. A lot is at stake. It could be their family, their businesses, their property, their liberty. And they come when they can't resolve their own disputes or they haven't been resolved outside the court. And so they come there, and at best, really, it's a 50-50 shot. So we have people leaving courts all the time that are unhappy. That's the way it is. They really believe in their case. When I was a legislator, I got lots of correspondence with people that were unhappy with a result. But what I'm talking about is their confidence going in. They have to believe that they have a fair shot when their case is heard. And so it's really up to you whether or not you are going to protect that. I think it's wishful, fanciful thinking to believe that these elections are not going to come to Minnesota. Wisconsin is very much like Minnesota. Washington State is a state I think has been known for good government in the past, and it's arrived there. And a final note, I just want to echo Representative Simon's comments about elections. It really does take kind of a sea change when we deal with elections. I have people ask me all the time, I don't know these judges I'm voting for today with the direct elections, one-on-one. And what should I do? And my general advice, and I really at that time was prohibited of saying, you know, vote for this judge, not that judge. We weren't supposed to do that under the rules. Improper. I'd say unless you have a reason to vote against a judge, I believe you shouldn't vote against a judge. We don't run on platforms. Legislators do. You may open your mind and change your mind with new information, but you have to take positions every day, stadiums, taxes, every issue. That is not what we do. That's not what we're supposed to do, is commit ourselves to a case before we get there. It's not out with the old, in with the new, with the judges. It's stay the course. That's what you want. You want judges to follow the law, not make new law, case by case. And so I hope that's what you do today is, or I know this is going hopefully to another committee, but I know that you are pressed this session. It's tougher than most. It's a very difficult session for you, and the significance of this bill may be lost in that equation. I believe it's one of the most significant pieces of legislation that you will have the opportunity to vote on. And while some of you may retire before these elections that we talk about come to Minnesota, I will tell you that whether they come to Minnesota or not is really going to happen on your watch. The time to deal with this issue is before people win at the game and the people in Minnesota lose. So I hope that you can support this important legislation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Susan Miles, I believe, has to leave, so we're going to get her up. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to appear today to state the position of the Minnesota District Judges Association on House File 224. My name is Susan Miles, and I am the president of MDJA and have served as a district judge chambered in Stillwater for the last 13 years. MDJA's dues-paying voting members include virtually all active district court judges in the state of Minnesota, plus some of our Court of Appeals and judges and Supreme Court justices. The concepts in the bill before you today have been the subject of discussion within our organization since the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Republican Party versus White in 2002. Until a year ago, our position was in favor of the status quo, that is, in support of contested popular elections and against retention elections. Last year, we vacated our previous position and referred the matter for further study by our Judicial Selection Committee chaired by Judge Tim Connell. We asked the legislature to focus instead on the judicial branch budget while we reconsidered our position. Then in September of last year, our membership overwhelmingly passed the resolution on the last page of the report and recommendations dated August 19, 2009. I believe you have copies before you. Judges are concerned about the health of the judicial branch and the public's trust and confidence in us. Obviously, these are very tough times in which we have lost 214 positions since the last round of budget reductions, with the possibility of the loss of another 100 positions if cuts recently recommended by the governor and the Senate become a reality. This would leave the branch understaffed by 13% and will force us to examine whether we can continue to handle lower priority cases. That said, this is not an ideal time to be discussing wholesale reform of the way in which judges are selected and retained. Since the issue is on the table, however, and we have an obvious stake in the outcome, we feel that we have a professional duty to comment on the bill insofar as it will have an impact on the quality of the work of the judges serving the citizens of this state. In good faith, we have debated these issues among ourselves and have freely shared our views with the bill authors and primary proponents, and we have continuously rolled up our sleeves to work to find solutions to the issue at hand. Nothing I say will come as a surprise to these interested parties. I'm happy to say that two of the issues of crucial concern to MDJA have been addressed in this bill draft. First, provision for a constitutionally created performance evaluation commission, which is an independent body not subject to the control of any branch of government. And second, a budget for the Performance Evaluation Commission, which is based on a source of sufficient, secure, and dedicated funds. We feel very strongly that the evaluations done by this commission must be fair and accurate, and therefore must be insulated from political and budgetary pressures. Although there is no fiscal note for this bill, we feel confident that all parties recognize the need to adequately fund this commission from a dedicated source. Unfortunately, a few key aspects of this bill currently fall short of the concerns raised in MDJA's resolution. Those issues are, first, the failure to provide for mandatory merit selection for all levels of the judiciary. Second, lack of a triggering mechanism which provides notice to a judge that his or her retention will be challenged. And third, lack of a uniform election system which applies to all judges and to all courts. Given these omissions, MDJA cannot support this bill at this time for the following reasons. First, dealing with the trigger point. In the eyes of the parties who appear before us, judges make controversial decisions every day. The very nature of our jobs is that we disappoint or anger legions of people, any one of whom can launch a viral campaign against our retention with postings on Facebook or an onslaught of tweets. Now that corporations can make independent expenditures in judicial races, the ante has increased. Under current law, we know by the close of filings whether or not we have an opponent and need to raise money. In contrast, under House File 224, we run the risk that someone with social networking savvy or a large financial war chest will ambush a sitting judge for reasons not having anything to do with the quality of our work, but having everything to do with revenge. To defend ourselves against this sort of ambush, we will need to raise money to launch our own campaigns if needed. A trigger point would remove our names from the ballot unless a petition were filed bearing a nominal number of signatures, was submitted by the closing of the filing window, or alternatively require some notice of intent to challenge a judge's retention by a date certain. While we appreciate and support the efforts of Representative Simon to ameliorate the potential for ambush by beefing up campaign finance provisions, this approach does not provide sufficient notice to us that a campaign is being mounted against us. Thus, we still have to raise money to finance a campaign. On to mandatory merit selection. A retention election system that does not include mandatory merit selection is hopelessly flawed. House File 224 does not include any provision for merit selection, leaving the current inadequate system in place. At present, merit selection applies only to district court judges, and its employment by any governor is entirely voluntary. Just as important, appellate judges are not even subject to the merit selection process. Consequently, any time any judge resigns from office or loses his or her seat in an election, the governor is free to choose a replacement regardless of qualifications. Without mandatory merit selection, retention elections are nothing more than an empty promise that a qualified replacement will follow. Disgruntled parties and special interest groups who are allied with a sympathetic governor can take out sitting judges and replace us with their pre-selected candidates. This stands in direct contrast with the goal stated by the proponents of this bill. MDJA will support a bill which protects the impartiality of judges while promoting accountability of judges to the public and is fair to all concerned. Unfortunately, although we're still talking, we're not quite there yet. We hope to get there. I will be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Representative Sterner, is it to the testifier?
Yes.
All right. Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Plowski. I met with three of my district court judges in Dakota County, and all three were highly in favor of this bill. And I'm just wondering how much of your membership is behind your official position and how much would maybe be in opposition to your position in favor of this bill.
Judge Miles.
Representative, or Mr. Chair and Representative Sterner, this is the resolution which is before you was voted on by the MDJA membership in September. 80% plus of those who voted on the resolution voted in its favor. Now, that resolution speaks to adopting no preference for either retention elections or contested elections. However, if you have a retention election system, various conditions must be met, and those are the conditions that we've been speaking with the authors about. Since I have begun to inform the membership about the progress of those negotiations, there has been a great deal of angst expressed over the lack of a triggering point, and my membership has made it quite clear to me that absent a triggering point, they cannot support the bill. So those may be the discussions that you're having with the membership. Further, the lack of a merit selection, mandatory merit selection provision in this bill is very recent news, and I have not even had the opportunity to have those discussions with my membership, and I am certain that when I do, I can predict the result. You're right, the membership will not support the bill as drafted. They are okay with retention elections. 80% of them are okay with retention elections, so long as the conditions are met.
Questions? All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're running out of time, members, so we've had both sides here. Representative Simon,
thank
give you,
you
the last word.
Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief, members. Just a couple of responses. You know, I very much respect the District Court Judges Association. I want to belabor the point. We're still ongoing. But members, the problem with this idea of a trigger, and you know, one would think that judges, more than most people, would realize this, you can't say that a committee or a person has to announce by a date certain that they're going to engage in constitutional speech. You just can't do that. You don't have to be a lawyer to know. We can't have a requirement where we say, anyone who wants to take out a judge, you have to register by September 1st or else you're muzzled and you can't express a preference. No judge has come up to me and told me what is even in the realm of constitutionality would work there. I've tried to accommodate the judges by putting in a host. You can read it section after section of protection after protection after protection, protections that I frankly don't personally feel all that comfortable with, that I think veer perhaps a little too close towards incumbent protection, but I was willing to do that to accommodate them, and I'm disappointed that after accommodating them on three out of their four issues, that they're not yet there, but I'm confident that we can get there. Members, to the bill as a whole, I would just say this. When we talk about outcomes, when we run for office, that's okay and natural and healthy. But there ought to be one safe place in our democracy where there are people of goodwill who are truly neutral, who have not telegraphed in advance how they're going to rule on a particular case or what the outcome will be. And members, we've been fortunate so far, post-White, not to have the tsunami that's hit other states in terms of big buck, highly ideological, and outcome-driven election campaigns, but they are coming. Mr. Wurzel himself was quoted as saying at one point in the newspaper in the last couple of years, you heard him testify here, he said, first one to spend $1 million is going to win a court seat. And that may be true. So I would urge us to fix the roof now and not later, and members, I would respectfully ask for your support for this effort that is almost 5 years in the making.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just boils down to one simple issue. Do we trust the intelligence and discernment of our fellow citizens? And with that, I ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Simon.
One more thing, Mr. Chair. I would say the same thing, and I would say if you trust the citizens, trust them to vote on this constitutional amendment. They can make a mature and informed decision, and they can decide whether or not they want to keep the current system of electing judges, candidate versus candidate, or go to retention elections. So I do trust the citizens. That's why I ask you to move this bill along. Thank you, members.
All right. The motion is to pass House File 224 as amended and re-refer it to civil justice. The clerk will take the roll.
Anderson?
Yes.
Biskin?
No.
Emmer?
No.
Nuttwall?
Yes.
Wilkie?
Yes.
Bornstein?
Yes.
Hahn?
Yes.
Kalin?
Yes.
Kiffmeyer?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Markford?
Aye.
Nelson?
Yes.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Sanders?
Yes.
Simon?
Yes.
Sterner?
Yes.
Winkler?
Yes.
Chair Pulowski?
Yes. All right, there being 14 ayes and 4 nays, motion prevails. The bill is passed. Representative Poppy.
I'd like to move the minutes of March 3rd, 2010.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.